Hello and welcome to episode 116 of the Crate and Crowbar. It is the 27th of October 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Graham Smith.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Good day.
If this sounds like a Crate and Crowbar from the past, the distant past of only several weeks ago, that's because Marsh has gone away, he's taking the night off, and Marsh is the only person who knows how to use the sound equipment that makes us sound nice.
Yes, the new microphones that our patrons generously paid for.
Indeed.
And now expect.
And now reasonably expect in every single episode. Unfortunately, none of us have the hardware understanding or the software apart from Marsh. We're going to fix that as soon as we possibly can, but not in time for today's podcast. So we've gone back to the old ways for a single episode, and I hope it's not a giant disaster and you haven't just fallen off your bike in horror or something. If you have, please write in. That would be quite funny. The news today, if there is news, which there is that as of about an hour ago, the Overwatch closed beta has started to pretty mild excitement all the way across Twitter, as far as I can tell. You guys in? You guys excited?
Some.
Okay, Graham, Tom?
I'm in, and I am excited, actually. Okay. I played BlizzCon last year, and it was good.
I'm pretty excited. I played three games before we started recording this podcast, and all of them were total disasters. Mm. Overwatch is Blizzard's TF2-style shooty man, but also a MOBA, perhaps, game. And, and all the games I played so far in my 100% loss record on Overwatch begins tonight and will hopefully keep going. I've played so little of it as a live game that I don't have a huge amount to add to what I spoke about a couple of weeks ago on the podcast when I talked about it after coming back from an event. But, I've seen a little bit more about how they've kind of planned to, there's some nice social things. They've kind of rolled back on Blizzard's previous sort of attempts to redesign multiplayer chat, basically, as far as I can tell, where with Hearthstone they obviously had the little emote commands and you couldn't chat to your opponent. Heroes of the Storm, there's team chat, there's no global chat, and it's very heavily reliant on contextual pings. I think Overwatch is the type of game where none of that stuff would work, so it just has chat and inbuilt voice chat, and it is the same as every other game. So it's sort of interesting, because when I spoke to them, they're a bit cagey about whether or not they would have another clever system to avoid actually making players talk to each other because of what that leads to, but no. So at the moment it's very friendly, because it's closed beta, but I would not be surprised if, I think it was mentioned on the pod before, despite the protestations of that community to not become toxic.
Sure.
The tools are definitely there for it to eventually shit itself inside out. But there's some more positive things that I've seen. So at the end of a match now, and this is different to the version I played, not only do you get like the play of the match moment where it does a replay of whatever the best individual feat of skill was, it now also flashes up like a series of like little awards that are sort of team agnostic. So it's like, this guy went on an 11 kill spree, this guy absorbed this amount of damage for his team, this guy did this much healing, and so on. And it'll pick like four of them, so they're four little mini players, and then everybody else can vote on which of them they like the most. And I don't know what that does. It's just like you commend them and you see that person's like award get voted up like a Reddit post or something, and maybe that conveys XP or something, or if it's just there's no negative side to it, you can't vote something down. So maybe it's just to encourage players to give each other a thumbs up at the end of the game. I've never been included in those stats, so there's never been the opportunity to give me the thumbs up. But after every game I have voted for somebody's, good for that guy, I'm glad he's having such a great time. What a wonderful experience he must be having, and so on. Makes me hopeful for my own future wonderful experiences where it won't be a total shit show, as far as I can tell. But that's not the game's fault. I think people are just learning it, and I think it's a bit one-sided at the moment. I had a game where it was just a crushing defeat because of people who obviously knew what they were doing. And I've had multiple games where I've been loaded into a game right as it's ending, because someone's dropped out with like a minute to go on the clock, and it just throws you in there for the end of the round. That feels a bit shitty. It feels like something they need to resolve, because that's not fun, like loading in and picking your character and being excited to start the game and then realizing, oh, I've been loaded in to lose.
Yeah.
Ah, we'll see.
That's kind of exactly what closed betas are for normally, isn't it? It's tune matchmaking and get the network features right. So
yeah. Oh yeah. It's not. None of this is like Overwatch is disappointing and broken and shit. It's just. It definitely. I would definitely like. To sort of settle into for it to settle into its matchmaking rhythm and so on, and that might be a bit weird for the next couple of weeks, I guess. The one thing that it doesn't give anything away of is what the business model for that game is going to be.
Right.
Like, really still very unclear. Like, they told me in an interview that every player would have access to every character, because that's important to the way the game is designed. A bit like it would be in TF2, where you need to be able to have access to the different classes. In the beta, every character is available to every player, and there's no hooks for microtransactions, and there's nothing else. I think the model that would make the most sense for that game is Counter-Strikes, basically. Like, I think that should be a $15 game where you can buy hats for the men and women, and so on, particle effects and skins and stuff. And, you know, have like, I don't know, blind box crates full of rare stuff and do the Counter-Strike economy, because that seems to work really well for Counter-Strike Go. But it could be a free-to-play game. I don't know. Just sort of is at the moment. Is what it is.
I played Overwatch a few months back, maybe at Gamescom or something, and it seems like it's the opposite of Team Fortress 2 in some ways. Like, it's easily compared to Team Fortress 2 because it's a class-based, team-based multiplayer shooter with cartoony characters. But when Team Fortress 2 came out, and it's less true now, maybe it's not true at all now, but when it came out, everyone praised it for how readable it was, that you knew what the sniper did, because he was called the sniper, and he carried a giant sniper rifle. You knew what the demo man did, and so on. And all the classes were easily identifiable based on the silhouettes. And the game got a lot of plaudits, a lot of praise. All the reviews mentioned it. Whereas Overwatch seems like the classes are much more peculiar. It's harder to read. Hey, that guy is a ranged guy versus that guy is a melee character versus, hey, that guy's just throwing a weird thing up onto this rooftop beside me. What's that weird thing? Oh no, oh god, he's teleported up here. That guy can teleport. How was I supposed to know that that guy could teleport? He wasn't called teleporter. And that seems like, it's not a criticism because people love that shit. And it feels like that's, like, if there is a UB game formula, it feels to me now like that's the Blizzard game formula. They take genres and make explicit the learnings that go into becoming good or useful in those genres. Like, the traditional arc of learning a first-person shooter game is you get better at shooting, and it's much harder to tell day-to-day that you're slightly better than you were at reflex clicking on a man's head than you were a couple of days ago. And it feels like by creating games that are just dense with a kind of explicit knowledge and that, you know, can fill a Wikipedia page or a wiki rather, in Hearthstone, in Heroes of the Storm, in World of Warcraft Raids, in StarCraft, and now in Overwatch, it feels like, you know, that's the Blizzard game template, is how do we make this into bespoke little chunks of knowledge so that there is this constant satisfying, hey, I learned a new thing, I learned a new thing, I'm getting better, I learned a new thing. Whereas I think for me, when I play those games, I think, God, there is a lot to learn, and the only way to learn it is either to go do a lot of reading or to just maybe trial and error, die a lot through play and have, you know, little unsatisfying experiences that maybe lead towards some sort of transcendent feeling of, I have accrued correct knowledge now. Now I am functional and useful as a human being.
Overwatch, I think, is an interesting relationship with that, because I think there's actually not that much to learn at the moment. It's like 18 characters or something. But also, it is really good at teaching you, because two things. One is the context-sensitive help tool tips. So if you get killed by something, it goes, you shouldn't have done that. That particular character is good against you in this scenario, and it's always context sensitive. So it's like, if you get shot by, I don't know, Farah, who is the jetpacking rocket launcher cool lady who looks a bit like Samus Aran, it will say, she's really good outdoors because she has a rocket launcher. Go inside, you idiot. Like, and so on.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so that's part of it, is like, it will tell you, you know, or, and that'll be specific to not only who you were just killed by, but also the character you are. So it's like, occasionally you get killed by somebody who actually should probably be weak against you, and it will say, like, actually, you're quite good in this matchup. Stop sucking. or thereabouts. The other thing is the kill cam, because before you respawn, you get to see your death from the point of view of your opponent. You learn what they did, and you learn how their abilities work. So it's not like a traditional MOBA thing, where you're basically only absorbing the information from your class in a given game. As long as you're paying attention, you don't completely switch off after you die. You will say, oh, that's what that thing does, because you'll see them use it. So you kind of, you accrue a lot of knowledge over time. Like, you know, the other day it was a really good shot. There's a guy, Hanzo, who can shoot an arrow that on impact turns into a bunch of splinter arrows that bounce around wherever they are, ricochet, mm-hmm. basically. So you can, you know, that's his thing. If someone ducks behind a wall, because normally he's got this, like, bow, so it's a single-shot powerful weapon. If someone ducks behind a wall, you can sort of fire it into the room they're hiding in and kind of do a lot of AoE damage. And the guy just did the most amazing anticipation shot. Like, he sort of knew the map, but this is when we got completely bodied in that game, and it was clear that maybe they were players from the Alpha or something, because it was like, on his kill cam, you saw him kind of like, watch me run away down one corridor, and then his cursor moves because he knows that there's another doorway that goes into the same area, like a full 90 degrees around from where he was facing, and then he fires the splinter arrow that way, and it ricochets into that room and kills me coming the opposite direction. Like, he fired ahead of me, basically, knowing exactly where I was likely to be going. And that moment was like, oh, that's how why that ability is really useful from this position on this map. And also, fair play. He got a little upvote from me at the end of the game for having such a brilliant time. Good for him. I think that's better than, you know, what the fuck just killed me? You might have that feeling, but you almost immediately get to see a more helpful explanatory view of it, which is like, oh, it's a black hole. Shouldn't have gone there.
I think for me it's the knowledge that to get good at the game is just going to be almost an endless series of those kinds of experiences. I'm just going to die on the beach of this game again and again and again until I've collected all the little knowledge peas on the ground.
What were the peas on the beach?
I don't know. why is knowledge peas?
Only Graham knows.
This is why war is such a mystery.
Yeah. Never changes, though. Yeah. That's the end.
That's the end of the podcast. That's the metaphor that killed this podcast.
And I guess it's a time thing. Maybe it's just a time investment. I see the time investment that it's going to take in order to get good at that stuff. And I've played years and years and years of first-person shooters. And so I have basic understanding of positioning, of movement, of aiming, and that sort of stuff. But that knowledge in a game like an FPS also kind of levels the playing field in some way, because although I can aim better, that's not the only thing that matters. It's also how well are you using your current class, how well do you know your current class, that kind of thing. And it just feels like someone else is always going to be committing more time. In fact, the vast majority of people are going to be committing more time than I am to ever playing something like that.
I can see that. I think maybe my frame of reference has been set by a different type of game that requires so much more knowledge that this feels like, yeah, I can do this. This is like 18 characters that don't have very many different things.
Yeah.
And actually, the shooting stuff still does level the playing field a bit. Like, if you can't hit, doesn't really matter how well you know the class, right? If you fire again, to return to her rocket launcher behaves a lot like a Quake rocket launcher. It really feels like the same shoot at the feet thing. And her extra degree of verticality, her jetpack doesn't really feel like a jetpack, like a tribe's jetpack. It feels like having a Quake bounce pad that you carry around with you. You know what I mean? And it's on its cooldown. And so every now and then you just get to go boing. And that's a really Quake 3 thing of like flinging yourself in the air and firing rockets as you come back down. And she can feather the descent with her jetpack thing. But nonetheless, right? Like, at that moment you're like, oh, it's this game I'm playing now. Whereas Widowmaker, the sniper, has a charge-up sniper rifle that's exactly like the TF2 charge-up sniper rifle. So he's like, oh, and I'm playing this other game that I also know.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's totally untransferable knowledge, which is like, I think Dota suffers from the fact that it's like, you don't really understand this stuff. You've stunned things in RPGs before, but you don't really understand why it's important here, what the timing is. Whereas in this, it's like, yeah, you understand guns. Like, you understand pointing guns at mans, and you understand grenades and what they do, and for the most part, like, those things will always apply. And then there are some weird things, like, you know, I was going to say, in contrary to the silhouette thing, I think a lot of the time the silhouette of a character in Overwatch does communicate roughly what they do. But then there are the huge glaring exceptions to it. So for the most part, like, the big solid characters, those are the tanks, and that's pretty much kept to. But you have, like, again, Farah, who's on a jetpack, has wings, and there's Mercy, who's a medic, who can't fly, but she has wings, because she's like, she looks like the medical symbol. Because she's a snake wrapped around a stick with wings. And,
but why is that the medical symbol?
I don't know. Mm. It's
like peas on a beach.
Exactly. Like, yeah, before we had medicine, he just got a load of feathers and a snake wrapped around a stick and hit people with it. And so there are moments where, like, if Farah and Mercy are running alongside each other, you might not realize one of these is a really dangerous rocket launcher person, the other's a medic. The other one is like, I definitely had a moment of confusion with a character I actually know, which is Winston, who's in the initial cinematic trailer. He's like the big gorilla in power armor.
Hmm.
All of his skill set really fits that theme. He's a tank, you get that. He's big. He's frontline bruiser. He can leap and smash things. And his ultimate ability, he kind of like hulks out. Basically, his glasses break. And then, without his glasses, he like gets bigger and gets huge amounts of health regeneration and but can only smash people for a while. And he kind of runs around smashing things. It's cool.
Sweet.
He hulks out. If a gorilla can hulk out, which I don't know if they can. But it's all fictional, so that's not important. He also carries an electricity gun. Because I think he needs a gun. Because I think he would be broken if he didn't have a gun. Well, there was a character with a hammer, but, like, and so he carries, like, a bit like a much lower powered version of the Quake lightning gun. In that it chains to enemies. But it doesn't do that much. It's not like a fry a whole room full of people instantly thing. But it's powerful-ish. And I was getting electrocuted, and I really didn't associate it with the monkey that was also beating me up. Like, I had to kind of watch my kill cam and go, oh, and I'd played him before, and I knew that he had an electricity gun, but there was definitely a disconnect between, you know, the visual shorthand of that character and the type of power that his model conveys, and the particular sort of, like, lightning tickling he was doing in that instance.
Is it explained in the lore? Is he, like, a mad scientist that's turned himself? Is he...
I don't know. I think
did he build the electricity gun and turn himself into a gorilla?
He has glasses, which means he's clever.
Yeah, he's like... I'm imagining Beast from the X-Men.
Yeah, no, he is, actually, yeah. No, he completely is. I think he's even voiced by what's-his-face, Chris Metzen. Like, he's the... Like, yeah, and so it's the... Blizzard thing of like, you know what, we like comic books. Well, this was a bit different, but ours now.
Yes. I really like the movement stuff in the game, like the thing you were saying about jetpacking and stuff, and you mentioned Hanzo before. Mm. I think he can like scale walls.
Yeah,
that felt really nice when I played it. And I played the new character they'd announced when I played it was the... I really fucking hate the character, to be honest, but the Brazilian street DJ,
yeah,
who loves sound and wants to drop some beats.
Yeah,
he felt really nice to play just because he was fast. He had the kind of speed of the scout. He can, like, could do little boosts and stuff like that.
He can skate up walls as well.
Yeah,
I think actually I quite like that character design because I couldn't tell, but he seems to be like the music he plays differs with the maps. I couldn't tell if that was true or not because we had one on our team, but like he can set his... He's a healer, but it's basically an aura.
Mm.
But he can set it from healing mode, which plays one kind of music, to like, I think it's like speed and aggression.
Yeah, and speeds up everyone around you.
Yeah, and his interface is like he's actually adjusting an equalizer on the fly, and he like shifts the entire team over onto it.
Is it he's actually a bard?
Like basically, yeah. He's like a roller bard. Roller skater, future bard.
Yeah.
Italian street DJ, roller bard.
Roller bard, yeah. Yeah. But his ult actually like drops the bass based on what track he's currently playing. I think it gives like an AoE shield to all his team. So the idea is you run in and then he's skating along and then he actually soundtracks it as it happens, which is kind of cool. That's like cool. It's a cool high concept for it.
Mm.
Like, it's nice that in a game that also has like the really obvious medic character whose name is Mercy and she's dressed like the medical symbol. She's a platinum blonde Swiss woman with angel wings and a halo who heals people and brings them back to life. It's nice that there are different variants on what medic means. You know, there's also a Brazilian street DJ who's probably annoying, but whatever. Yeah, I think the character design across the board is really good, actually. It's derivative, but it's effective, which you could say of every Blizzard project for a long time. But yeah, I like it, and after this podcast I'll play it again.
I'm going to boot it up and check it out.
Tom, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't really have many thoughts about games, but I will for a moment talk about the Mouse Utopia Universe 26, which should be a game. And
is this a place you've been?
This is, thank fuck I haven't been there, because let me tell you, it's not a good place. It was this is an experiment done in the 60s on mice, and it was an attempt to create, to study the effects of overpopulation on animals. And so he created 25 of these universes, apparently. I have no idea what happened in the other 25. 26 went pretty bad, but it's a really interesting...
When you say universes, do you mean like habitats for mice?
Yes. He called them universes because he was a bit dramatic.
You're really into DC Comics.
Yeah, it's Universe 26, and it's just a big mouse city, and it was supposed to be perfect. So it was supposed to have just the right amount of space for the number of mice in there, and they had food, as much food as they needed. They had enough male-to-female ratio is good, really good for breeding and stuff. And you know, they set up shop pretty quickly, and there were like little mouse sectors and little territories emerged and stuff like that. And they found over the course of a year that with constant food supply, that was completely fine. There was no scarcity. The population expanded as you'd expect, and then there was total social collapse, and just a horrifying scale. Such a horrifying scale that this was published in Scientific American and inspired a load of the social collapse disaster movies that followed in the next decade or two. And it's...
What does it look like when mouse society collapses?
Really, really horrible.
Okay.
So they start eating each other.
Okay.
And they can eat normal food if they want to, but you know they're pressing up against each other, so they start killing each other a lot because there's, you know, there's just being there being too many of them is the problem, and so they attack each other. Then the mice that grow up in that environment have absolutely no kind of social rules to abide by. So mouse society actually, over the course of a few generations, just dissolves to the extent that they stop breeding because they just forget how to court. And how to have sex and how to raise children and what they're supposed to do. And the guy who did this experiment said that if you were a mouse born into that situation, you wouldn't even feel alienated because you would have no concept of society at all. You would just be a roaming kind of node, and you might get eaten by another mouse.
How does he know that? What's a little mouse philosopher like staring over the wasteland of what society has become?
It's when the mice created like the Judge Dredd mice to patrol the megaplexes and bring...
Apparently, like there were... There were some of the female mice were kind of like they were protected, and they were still protected by the men, but they had no concept of how to breed or what they were supposed to do, and they were called the beautiful ones, and they were just segregated in the middle
by whom?
By him again. Okay. So he's called it a utopia. He's kind of, it applies a kind of philosophical thought to these mice, and he had kind of like a sensationalist streak in him, but it's that doesn't demean how horrible the stuff he observed was. And so the beautiful ones would cluster in the middle, and a load of mice would just cluster in the middle and just stare outwards and not do anything. And while there was just a mouse war raged around them. And even when population levels returned to the initial level, like the ideal level, society was so broken that they all just died. Like the generations, they just stopped breeding. That was the end. And when this study was published, it was seen as like, is that what humans would do? Maybe. maybe. Humans would kind of just... there's this huge panic, and still is really, about overpopulation, population growth, and what that means for humans. But what I find interesting about it, that as soon as I read about it, I was like, that's horrible. What an awesome game that would be. Because it's social behaviour expressed through systems and through numbers of things. And maybe think of like Democracy 3 and Prison Architect and things like that, where you are running little social simulations. And actually, if each of these mice is just a little AI construct, you could mess with them and play with them without actually having to have mice eat each other in a big, horrible kind of utopia.
Well, that could just be emergent behaviour. You know, you don't have to be morally responsible for directing them to do it. Sometimes,
yeah,
sometimes mice just go there.
They just go there. And I'd quite like a little kind of cage of, not if not humanity, then little kind of living nodes. This probably says more about me than the sort of thing that people would actually like to play, but I think I like the idea of systems driven behavioural studies and things like that. Where
did you ever play Sim Ant?
No, sounds like my kind of game though.
It was, I think, designed by Will Wright, and it was based on studies of ant societies from the same era. And ants are often used as examples of emergent behaviour because they form little societies with workers and military ants, and their societies all about
firemen.
Yep, little angel wings on the the doctor ants, and they've got a queen, and they leave pheromone trails for one another, and they those pheromone trails then signal where to the rest of the colony where they can find, hey, I found some food here. And they will leave a trail, and someone else will come and get the food, and they'll mark out an area to be, this is where we put the dead ants, this is our graveyard, and they will keep that separate from their food and stuff like that.
That's amazing.
And so there's a bunch of studies about this, and about how, you know, ants, very simple, like in terms of their actual intelligence, but society emerges from these quite simple systems, and they form a kind of swarm intelligence, essentially.
That's awesome.
And SimAnt basically was a simulation of of some of those systems. And it was made, I think, very early 90s. Mm-hmm. It was after SimCity when Maxis were going nuts with all the Sim games.
It was the definitive, like, PC World bargain bin game.
Yeah.
It really was.
It was, indeed. And so it was pretty basic by today's standards, I think. But I always loved that idea as well. And that's kind of why I like things like Dwarf Fortress and Prison Architect. To have a little bit of that sense of, well, playing with an ant farm or a mouse universe.
Yeah, stuff like Maya as well. There are a few kind of ones on the periphery that are doing these kind of sandbox games where the AI is independent of you. So the people living in the universe you've made behave autonomously. And then the fun of it is just watching what happens, like poking the ant's nest and seeing who eats who.
There was another series called Creatures. Did you play those?
No, I've not played Creatures.
Creatures were like little cute bunny-like things that you could care for, almost like Tamagotchis, in terms of feeding them and giving them care and building them a little habitat where they had things to entertain themselves. But again, their AI was independent of you, and you could just try to steer or influence them. And part of steering and influencing them was selectively breeding in order to like pass on certain genetic traits. And some of those traits would be appearance, and some of those would be behavioral. And so you could, again, early 90s AI programming stuff, it was sometimes hard to discern cause and effect and stuff, but there were ways in which you could sort of shape their behavior over generations make them afraid of certain things or make them really like certain things stuff. Huge potential in this.
Darwinian simulation is really fascinating. Like the transition from success to ingrained behavior, like a successful trait that becomes ingrained, you know, part of DNA, how that works. That's another system that feels like could be amazing to play with in games. And there must be I imagine there are science institutes actually running simulations of this stuff. It just hasn't been gamified yet.
You don't have to kill shitloads of mice anymore.
Yeah, just put them in a computer. It's fine. Not the mice in the computer. That's mice.
Yeah.
Universe 27.
It's the Matrix.
I really want to read about the other 25, but I also really don't. I don't know what you did to them.
Yeah. One is, like, one of the ones where, like, Superman lands in Russia instead, and...
I like the idea that the society dying out, it's not because they forgot how to breed, it's just because the ones that were left knew that they had gone too far, and that
their
time was over, and that it was time to let themselves die off and let nature reclaim Universe 26.
If they'd have left it another, kind of, 6 or 8 months, you'd have had like a little mouse Mad Max.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that. I was going to ask you earlier, like, was this just a dream you had after eating loads of cheese and watching Mad Max and Ratatouille? Or something?
Like, 3 or 4 elements combined.
But yeah, no, it already sounds like it already did go pretty Mad Max with the corralling the women in one place, certain big rats ruling everything.
Yeah.
The little cards.
And just eating each other's children and stuff. Like, mothers giving birth and eating their children. Just absolute horror. Just the worst thing you could imagine happening to a society, happening in a room with a lot of mice. It was bad, but very interesting. Which is what you can say about all the best psychological experiments. Where there are no ethical committees or any of that shit.
Yeah.
What have you been playing, Graham?
Well,
that doesn't really count as playing, but you know, whatever.
my games pale in comparison, really. I've been playing two things. First of which, Wheels of Aurelia, which is a narrative driving game. Which sounds fucking great. And all the things that are interesting about this game are kind of great. It's a narrative driving game played from an isometric perspective. It's all kind of blue skies, blue oceans, green fields. You're driving along. You accelerate automatically, although you can press a button to speed up. You steer left or right. We're using the left analog stick. And then up and down on the same stick, you choose dialogue options. And it's set in the 1970s in Italy. And you are a woman wearing it with like a punk haircut, leather coat, sports car, driving along these kind of coastal towns in Italy on your way to the French Riviera. And to start with, your companion in the car is a woman as well, and you can have conversations with her, and the conversations range about politics and feminism and your personal lives. And it's just a lovely idea. I really like driving in games. I've talked before in the podcast a whole bunch, not racing, but just driving in Euro Truck Simulator, in city car driving. I find that really soothing and relaxing, and the art style in this is lovely, and pairing that with a narrative game is a really nice idea. As well, just a few weeks ago, I was talking about 80 Days, which is another game about travel and about companionship. And as you drive along, you're following the dialogue, and depending on what choices you make, it branches. There are points where you can pick up hitchhikers that sit in the backseat, you can have little conversations with them. The road forks a little bit, so, and that can changes, what happens with your companion, because if you make the wrong choice or make a deliberate choice, you can throw her out of your car, she can leave, you get a new guy, you talk to them, or you get very different endings. And each session of the game takes about 15-20 minutes to play through. And so it compels you to go back and say, oh, what happens if I choose this option? What happens if I take that right turn? And like 80 Days, a forking road is a really good way of convincing you that your decisions matter.
Mm.
You know that the content isn't repurposed if you go from this town rather than this town. It's quite distinct in that way. So that's all great. And if you Google for it, you'll find many game journalists who like it. And I understand, because all the things that are most interesting about it, the things you want to say, the things you want to tell people about, are cool. Except I don't think it works, or it's very fun to play. And that's a bunch of different reasons. One is that the controls don't really work, and the different sides of the game fight one another. Trying to steer your car around the other vehicles on the road and avoid the sides and stuff like that and make dialogue decisions is quite difficult. And it means that you're never quite paying enough attention to either one of them, nor really having the time to enjoy the beautiful scenery. It feels like it should be a game about taking a relaxing Sunday drive and talking to someone as you go, but there's this constant it's kind of frustrating. I keep banging into the cars, I keep banging into the side, and there's technically, or initially, no punishment for that. Your car kind of auto-corrects a little bit. You can bump into the other cars on the road. There's no major crashes. There's no damage mod. You can just keep going. But it feels kind of shitty. It feels like you're doing part of the game wrong.
Right.
And then there are points where it seems from the different branches where if you drive shittily, then you are, if not punished for it, then you are now going down a branch of the story that maybe you didn't want to go down. And it's a similar thing. Again, I keep coming back to 80 Days, but 80 Days has this relationship with Fogg where you can decide to be a really good valet and make him like you and have a really good relationship with him, or you can, he's fine, he's a bit seasick, I could comb his beard or whatever, but actually I want to go flirt with some sexy mathematicians and have adventures and get into fights and stuff.
Mm.
But those feel like purposeful decisions. Those feel like it says something about the kind of passepartout that you want to be based on whether you decide to be caring and fastidious or whether you choose to be reckless. And there are points where Wheels of Aurelia reacts to you, which feel like But I didn't mean to do that. It wasn't characterful, this decision. I drove shittily because I was struggling to deal with the three different branches of the game. A, experiencing the scenery. B, having the dialogue. C, steering around the cars. And it feels like it just kind of trips over itself. And on top of that, it's never as rewarding as I want it to be when it comes to the dialogue decision choices you're making. Sometimes you'll make a choice and it will seem to be going down an interesting path, and then the character you're talking to will remark upon a piece of scenery. And that's a nice thing, that they have that kind of dynamic ability to say, hey, look at that great castle, and that can spark a conversation. But because you can control your speed of the car, the point at which you reach that castle is different, and it might come in the middle of a conversation that was really interesting, and perhaps sometimes where someone has just said something quite dramatic that you want to react to, but then those dialogue choices just go away because she just remarked about a castle and you can't take the conversation back.
So she'll be talking about how, oh, yeah, and then I killed him with a knife, and oh, hey, what about that castle then?
Which feels like, you know, there's almost a thing there of, oh, you know, they could be, like, deliberately changing the subject. Mm. Like, that could be characterful, but it's not. It's just an accident of these different systems that aren't well-developed enough to lead to the kind of experience it's trying to create. And there are points as well where, like, you say things, you have conversations, and then later in the script it seems like they don't know that that conversation has happened. There isn't enough variables tracking that stuff. There's points where they refer to themselves as just being alone in the car, but you've picked up a hitchhiker, and you never drop off the hitchhikers. There are other characters...
they just keep getting in.
Yeah, they just keep getting in, and that's kind of weird. And they will say, oh, you know, it's the first right... But if you take the first right or go straight on, doesn't matter. If you never see them again, you use up their dialogue options and then they vanish as if like a puff of smoke.
It's not like a clown car where it's just millions of them in there with you and you've got to look.
Well, that's the other alternative. But, you know, there's cool stuff about the branching as well. Like, you can, if you take one route, there's a guy that challenges you to a race. And if you lose the race, you lose your car. And then that can lead to a whole bunch of things with your pack companion that's coming along with you. I ended up having to ditch her entirely, we had to go our own way, and getting in a different car and then picking up a priest and having a whole thing with him. But, you know, and then I've gone back and I've played it and I've taken a different route and I didn't lose my companion, I didn't lose my car, I didn't have a race, I didn't meet the priest, I had completely different experiences. So cool. That's like cool stuff. But these systems aren't refined enough. And there's fiddly things in the controls. Like, for example, again, losing my companion after I lost my car happened because after you've driven to a section, there's then like a cutscene, and it's just like static images of talking heads where dialogue comes up and they're about 30 seconds long. And I've seen a whole bunch of these and never had to do anything other than watch. You don't even have to click to progress it. And then suddenly a dialogue choice came up and they're all timed and you've got like 6 seconds. And then it's that thing of you're kind of sat back watching a cutscene and all of a sudden it demands something of you and I'm scrambling to reach my keyboard to hit the button in time. And actually, I just said, yeah, I think we should go our own way. Like, it wasn't an insignificant choice. I just ditched my companion outright because I couldn't press a button in 3 seconds because that choice happened in the middle of a cutscene with no precedent for there being choices in the middle of a cutscene.
It's interesting. Normally, I'd advocate games giving as much control to the player as possible, but I think there are games that definitely know when to take control away and just put you on rails when the game is about rails. So you talk about 80 Days Perfect because that literally lays out the routes, as you say, and that is just like this map through the game. But something like Son of the Sea, which I get frustrated with it because I'd enjoy it more if it was more honest about the fact it was about stories and about going, you know, taking routes through stories, and if it was trying less to be a survival game or trying to be something else,
trying to be a board game.
Yeah, it would be a great game actually. I wanted to read the wiki of it, the stories, rather than actually kind of go back to the port and then back to the island and then back to the port and back to the island to actually uncover all the kind of stages of each of these little quests. And Banner Saga as well, which I love the way that Banner Saga kind of makes you watch the journeys, but only bothers you when there's actually a choice to be made and doesn't kind of catch you out in the ways that it sounds like this game does. So there seems to be an art to taking control away from the player and letting them know when they're in a relaxed phase, when they're in a decision-making phase.
Yeah, and not suddenly introducing a QTE, essentially.
Yeah, don't do that ever.
It sounds like it'd be an amazing candidate for, like, smart voice recognition, so you actually said the options you wanted to say.
Mm.
Or, like, you know, or a game where it's a European Truck Simulator, but you're in the cab with, essentially, a really smart, narrative-driven chatbot that, rather than being fixed dialogue options, you just talk to, like it's Siri or something, but with a story to tell. Because then you actually have the experience of having to have a conversation with somebody while driving, but without the conversation also requiring like a separate steering wheel, which sounds like it's kind of the situation you're in, right? It's like you're in a car with two steering wheels. One of them controls the car. The other one controls your mouth.
There's like, I was thinking of like different ways to solve it. I mean, the most obvious would be to just have like an autopilot button. So if you want to deal with the dialogue now, you hit the autopilot button and the driving takes care of itself. But that feels slightly unsatisfying. I would rather it was a more deliberate or characterful decision to decide, you know what, I'm going to ignore the dialogue. I'm going to drive like a bat out of hell. And maybe characters reacted to that or the story reacted to that more.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, it just, that doesn't feel like a valid choice. Like, you can sort of see how it might, like, because it's 70s Italy, and it's very political, and the conversations about communism and feminism and so forth, and you're dressed like a punk, you're wearing a leather jacket, you're running away from your family for various reasons. You can understand why maybe you don't want to have conversations, maybe you just want to drive as fast as you can to get to the French Riviera and stuff like that. But unfortunately, it doesn't really support that. So the flip of all that is, all the first things, all the beginning of this conversation, all the interesting things I said, those are good. I really want this game to be good. I really want it to be a success. It's made by Santa Ragione, who made an infinite runner called Photonica, and made Mirror Moon, which is a really interesting puzzle game. And it's currently in beta, although you can buy it. You buy it directly from their site. So they're selling it already, but it's not finished yet. Hopefully they'll fix some of these issues.
Sounds nice, as an idea. I love obviously more road trip games.
Yeah. There's another one I'm really looking forward to called Hack. It's about HAC, which is a first person game where set in former Yugoslavia and those parts of Eastern Europe in the 1980s, where you drive a shitty kind of beat up car up the coast of Yugoslavia with your uncle, I think on a kind of road trip, perhaps towards your dad's funeral or something like that. I can't remember. But what's cool about it, other than all the things I just said, it's partly procedural in terms of its environments. So procedural roads, procedural cities and stuff like that. And it looks really great. It's made by a guy that used to work on racing games at Codemasters. And then the other thing is that everything is diegetic in terms of your interactions with it. So you will run out of petrol and your car will degrade and you might have to stop off at a petrol station and you will get out of the car in first person and you'll walk into the petrol station and it's not like a menu that comes up. You pick things off shelves. You walk up to the counter. You drop the things you've picked off shelves onto the counter. You bring out your wallet. Your wallet is an actual thing. You flick through the money in it. We talked, I think, last week about maps and cartography and how much I like the map in Far Cry 2 because it's an actual physical thing and it's the same in Hack. If your car breaks down, you've got tools in your boot and you can actually go get the long columnar thing that you use for taking the bolts out of wheels. I don't drive or have any.
The bolty stick.
Yeah, the bolty stick to take the bolts out of the wheelie bits, the wheels. And you physically do all these things, and I really love that in games, and that looked really cool.
Yeah, I love that as well. I spent ages, like, shuffling the papers around in Papers, Please. So, yeah, you can just kind of click and drag them around your top.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm going to arrange this so good. And now on to the oppression. Decision-making.
The other game I've been playing, which ties neatly into that stuff, is Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes, which is a game Marsh talked about last week. Do you guys know it?
Is it the one that's based on that VR game about bomb defusal?
It is that VR game about bomb defusal, okay. Which was originally made as a prototype for Global Game Jam in 2014 for the Oculus Rift, but they've now released it, so you can play it on your regular, not Rifts. And it doesn't need VR at all. Like, it kind of, like, the idea is that one person is the bomb defuser. You're the only person that can see the bomb, and you're talking to other players that have the bomb defusal manual. And you have to communicate back and forth about what you're seeing, and they look it up in the manual and tell you the results. And it's strange symbols, it's strange codes, it's differently coloured wires, and which wire you have to cut is based on not just what colours you've got, but how many wires, and what's the code on the side of the box mm-hmm. with the identification number, and what's this little light doing, and then it starts introducing Morse code that you've got to break down, and it gets really complicated as you go along. And it's a brilliant co-op game. So I was playing it today with two other people from RPS, Adam and Pip, and started off with me as the bomb diffuser and then with the manuals, and I'd never seen the manuals. And this is all stuff that Marsh described, so I won't go into too much detail about it. But it isn't like the only thing that makes it suit VR is that VR headsets obviously mean you can't see what's going on outside of the headset while people can't see what you're seeing in the headset. So that has that kind of dividing wall. But so does the internet. You just hop on Skype and they have a PDF on their screen and you're playing the game. But what I really liked about it, what I wanted to talk about, was it's really great as a game which kind of is its own tutorial.
Right.
It is a game about learning how to play the game. Because, like, it's got these, like, 2 10-second tutorials at the start, which just say, you left-click to click on things, you right-click to put things down, you hold the right mouse button to rotate it. You know, it just describes the controls, and everything else is just, every level is about you working out, what the fuck is this thing? How does this play? How do I describe this? What is this thing? It's a little LED with 6 words underneath it. How does that work? What do we do? And it's a game about, like, learning how to play it under pressure, which is just really neat. And it created a bunch of situations which were funny, intense, and exciting. And it didn't require anyone to know how to play it. In fact, it's better if you don't know how to play it, if you go in kind of blind and just learn through playing. And it's not fixed levels, there are fixed levels and they ascend in difficulty really carefully, but they're a little bit randomized as well. So the other thing we did was we took it in turns being the bomb diffuser. So I was the bomb diffuser first, and Adam and Pip were on the manual. And then when I died, winner stays on, someone else hopped on to become the diffuser. And so now I was looking at the manual for the first time, and we went back to the first level and started it again. But all the levels were slightly different, so it was that same learning experience, and everyone had that kind of arc of trying to work out how to play this thing, and that being a really exciting experience, which learning how to play games aren't normally learning's normally the thing that you've got to kind of get through in order to get to the fun.
Yeah.
Or everyone's got to have at least a certain amount of familiarity. But this is quite a complicated game, and it's a multiplayer game, it's a co-op game, which I think you could probably play with people who don't play games. You could get your mum to sit in front of a PDF, and if they've ever done a crossword or Sudoku or any other kind of paper puzzle, then they will have the know-how to, you know, identify a symbol and read some instructions. You know, the thing that makes it hard isn't necessarily the complexity of it, it's the fact that you're trying to do it under time pressure, and you're trying to do 6 of them before your friend blows up.
That's really awesome. It reminds me a little bit, though not for the tutorial reasons, of Artemis Bridge Simulator.
Or Space Alert, which is a board game.
There's a lot of kind of equivalences. I wonder if, did Artemis look at the board game and then go, is that really similar?
I think the board game came first. Whether it's a case of one was inspired by the other, or just they grew independently, I don't know.
So Artemis Bridge Simulator, each player takes control of a different console on what's essentially the Starship Enterprise, and you've got the weapons guy and the engineer guy and the captain, and you all have different screens and completely different ways of interacting with the game, and you have to communicate a lot to get through space scenarios. You have to go and investigate an asteroid that might be attacked, and you might have to not nuke yourself, which I think we did when PC Gamer played this for a diary feature once.
Yep.
That was a good feature. That's a very silly photo shoot attached to it.
Yeah, it's Spock years on for that.
Fantastic. You made a very good Vulcan, Graham, I'd say.
Thank you. And little fake Enterprise signs on our for the badge, man, that we cut out of paper and
really went to town,
stuck on with silly tape.
It was like we were fulfilling some sort of weird dream. Yeah, it's good. We'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah, it was good.
I played that in my bedroom once as the captain. I couldn't bear to sit down to play it, so I spent the entire game stood up in my room. No one could see this, but with like one leg up on my chair, so that I was sort Riker of style. I was doing the Riker kind of like lunge onto a nearby piece of furniture at all times. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it's a fun game.
It's up on Steam now as well. Like when we played it, it wasn't, and it is now. And loads of people, well, some people, probably like 5 people, have made custom scenarios, because that's what we were playing for it. Like, the game doesn't really come with its own set of missions, whereas the thing we played was like recorded like a radio play, basically, of like people like hailing you and the fake Klingons sending you messages and stuff.
Some really good voice acting.
Yep. Really.
Great.
Really good. Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Good. That is what we have prepared for.
All this time.
Aiden writes, "Hi folks. I have followed a lot of competitive games over the years and often find myself enjoying the hyped up matches more than the interesting matches. League of Legends is a good example of this, as Riot and Reddit work in combination to add a narrative to a player or team's career. However, I often think the hype is unwarranted. Some players are famed for certain champions, but if you watch the game, you wouldn't think they were any better or worse than another pro. A good example is Edward from Gambit. He's been lackluster on Thresh for years, but after missing 6 hooks, the casters go crazy when the 7th hits, hailing him as the Thresh Prince." Very good casters, I like that.
That was good.
My questions.
Sorry, go on. Is he from Edward Gaming, or is, what's the guy's name? Because
he says Edward from Gambit. So maybe the guy's name is just Edward, and he plays for a team called Gambit?
The greatest esports team name in the history of electrical sports is Edward Gaming, the Chinese League of Legends. So there isn't a better team name than that.
We wrote about them recently on RPS, and there was a very good comment saying that Edward Gaming sounded like a Charles Dickens character. and went on to write a short story involving 5 orphans who all play the role of Edward Gaming in order to maximise their skills and progress through tournaments that they could not if they were known to be...
5 orphans.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, I instituted the style guide rule for PC Gamer Pro that means you're never allowed to abbreviate Edward Gaming to EDG, which is what everyone calls them.
Mm.
You must give them their full name. Edward, not Ed Gaming, Eddie Gaming, Edward Gaming is the full name.
I agree. Aiden goes on and says, "My questions. 1, how do you feel about hype as applied to players or teams? 2, does it matter if the public are unable to accurately understand whether a player or strategy is good, rather than simply be told they are by the casters or Reddit, whether or not it is true? I include myself in this lack of understanding. I'm not a pro, so a lot of nuance is missed when I watch a game. Thanks, Aiden."
So, I mean, there's, like, narrative building is a thing that probably exists in all sports. I think it's particularly, he points out a way in which it's particularly weird for esports, because esports are really hard to watch. Like, most human beings can watch a man kick a ball real good and go, "I couldn't do that, that looks hard. He's kicked that ball with exceptional skill and I appreciate him for it." Whereas in the esport, it's not necessarily obvious how difficult the thing the person is attempting is and whether or not they succeeded and so on. So you do get a lot of, I guess, hype is the word, when, you know, around moments in games that maybe are not that spectacular generally, but are spectacular but for invisible reasons, or are hugely visually impactful but easy. And the kind of, I guess, the correct level of excitement for each of those things can kind of swing around. I don't think broadly it's a problem as long as people are having fun, basically. Like, I think what it comes down to, it's like, if a game is lively and people are having fun watching it, and people have the infectious enthusiasm of somebody listening, then it doesn't necessarily matter if they're being slightly misled on how real, quote-unquote, the skill on display actually is. Because the moments when things really do hit off, I still think it works, you know? Like, even if you've been primed on lesser plays, then when you see the really big stuff is still the really big stuff. It doesn't really matter if you were...
I don't play any MOBA, and I've played very little of a few of them, so I have a basic working understanding of the elements of the genre, but not of any particular hero or anything like that. But I can still understand when a big team fight happens and the balance of a game tips in the favor of one team versus another. And I watch a lot of sport, and I watch more or less any sport because mostly I just care about the narratives. And even if I don't know anything about the narratives coming in, most sports, the commentators are pretty good at giving you some sense of this person's been on a losing streak recently, this person's the underdog, this team's the underdog, that sort of stuff. So it does, like, in any sport, it's not just esports, but in any sport, there are a thousand things going on the court or on the pitch that the layman watching isn't going to understand. Whether it's tennis or golf or anything. I don't know anything about tennis stances, but if you tell me that these guys have lost the Open the last three times and, you know, after winning it the four before that or something, then I understand what the narrative is there and I'll watch it and I'll quite enjoy it. So I agree with what you said, Chris. Chris writes, not you, I take it, but sorry, another Chris, there's more than one.
There's lots of them.
Dear broken planks of wood and spattered blood, I was wondering what the Podders thought about oats in games with persistent developed characters but no particularly meaningful storyline differences. Oats.
Oats.
As an alternative characters.
I don't taste your breakfast.
Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah. Oats.
Damn the Scottish brogue. Such as MMOs or games like Diablo. I'm personally the sort of player who is quite happy to play through the same content on all the different classes or character types available. In World of Warcraft, for instance, I have 8 out of 11 classes at level 100 on the Alliance side, and will get them all to 100 by the new year, plus a Horde character on another server just to see the minimal storyline differences. In Diablo 3, I've got characters of every class as well, and I've likewise always created alts on other MMOs such as Guild Wars 2 or Star Wars The Old Republic pretty much right away, even though I also always have a main character that I'll concentrate on. How about you lot? Thanks for splintering, dead bodies. Chris.
Chris?
That's what it's, oh, it's that's the end of the,
his name, yeah. Yes. I'm terrible with alts. I never do it. I always think I will, and then I just have one guy forever, and that's how I play games. I'll keep doing lower reward tasks on the same guy because it feels like more like progress than going all the way back to level whatever as someone else.
I would do much the same. And if I start an alt, I will get to level 6 with that character and then be like, oh, okay. And then I'll feel satisfied. Like, whatever my curiosity was, it was a very basic, what is it like to be this person kind of curiosity, not what is the arc of the entire game like, the progression curve and so forth. I never do that. It's the same with single player games. I always think, oh, I'll go back and I'll play that through a second time, and instead of leveling my Skyrim character to be the stealthy archer thievy guy that I always go for, I'll go for more of a brute force. Never happens. Never do it. Doesn't matter how much I like the game.
I've got a few alts in Guild Wars 2 now, which is causing problems because the new expansion has just come out. And my level 80 character is a tiny 2 foot tall necromancer who dressed all in red. And necromancers, their new kind of big special thing is that they can wield great swords. So this 2 foot tall dude with a great sword. And I love that idea. But when he's wearing it on his back, it glitches into the floor, like half of it just glitches into the ground. And that infuriates me so much that I actually want to... I've got like a level 25 hunter who's just a human, and he's got like a big feather in his hair. He's got a bear. The bear's awesome.
Is there a feather in the bear?
A feather, not on the bear, no.
Okay.
But you could probably buy that as cosmetic, but sadly not. And so now I kind of attempted to level him all the way up to 80 to play the expansion because it irritates me so much, looking at my stupid little man and his massive, massive weapon.
Alright.
So to speak.
Travis writes, hello people. Why is there so much torture in games these days? NGS5 prompted this question with its endless explicit and implied torture scenes, but it can also featured in GTA 5 too. I can't stand it. I have a hard enough time coming to terms with torture being a part of our reality. I don't want it in my leisure activities. Is it just cheap taboo shock? If so, once torture becomes commonplace in computer games, what are they going to drag out next in an effort to disgust and disturb? Thanks, Travis.
I think it is often tawdry and for shock value, but I think it's more just like lazy storytelling. In order to get someone to do something really quickly, what do we have to do? Oh, what if you torture him to get the information, and then we could just have a 3-minute scene instead of, you know, actually having a good reason for the guy to give you the information. It's much harder to, you know, come up with a good motivation for the guy to give you the information. Or it's much easier to just do a quick torture scene. You see this in television all the time, and films as well.
Yeah.
I think in games particularly as well, it's a way that they can frame a cutscene as sort of a challenge with the QTE torture sequence that became really popular for, like, Splinter Cell for a while and so on, where, you know, you could, not only is it an efficient narrative way, efficient but dumb narrative way to get a character to kind of talk, to, you know, tell you where your next mission is going to be, basically. You could just have them talk in a cutscene, but that's boring and people might switch off. Whereas if you want people to be able to interact in some way and there's no real peril for the main character, then why not smash his head through a sink? Why not? Or something. Or, like, hit a man with a bandsaw or whatever it is that you're going to do, and it, just to kind of, you know, it's the most cynical way of putting it, but to make it interactive, to add a degree of challenge to what would otherwise just be a completely perfunctory kind of narrative thing.
I that's why I'm really excited about Deus Ex, the kind of conversational combat stuff they tried to do. Trying to actually gamify a conversation instead of turning it into a torture scene, which is what almost every other game would do with that idea. So hopefully I'd like to see more of that
sort. Yeah, it would be a huge shame if they had the ability to kind of, like, brute force those sequences by, like, okay, we can try and finesse this with pheromones, or I'm just going to robo-punch you in the dick until you tell me what you need.
So there was a brief little period where, when there was all the modern military shooters around, where some of them were, like, spinning off real-world events, and adding context to the story by trying to link it back to the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And some of them would use actual war footage in, if not their trailers, then, like, their opening cinematics. And some of those I found really worse than tasteless, just disgusting. Like, all right, your game is about shooting digital men's, but some of them just had, like, famous war footage of prisoners of war being shot in the back of the head as they're lined up along the side of the road, and it's like, yeah, this is a quite trashy, pulpy kind of military game, and that's fine, but don't contextualize it by using actual footage of an actual man who actually died in the actual real world. That's grim.
Yeah, Company of Heroes 2 did this as well, when I think one of the first trailers they released was just cut up war footage, like black and white war footage, not of people being killed, but of armies marching around. And actually, those people really died.
Yeah.
That's like real stuff.
Yeah. It perpetuates this idea that torture works as well.
That's
probably the biggest problem with it in games. Yeah. Like, compared to, I mean, obviously it's true of every form of fiction where the good guy, quote unquote, tortures somebody, but in games it literally turns into like a reliable reward loop.
Like
Pummel Man. I think Metal Gear definitely has its problems with it, but it also has, I still think Ground Zeroes has some pretty strong things to say against torture, about the pointlessness of torture. We've spoken about that before.
Yeah.
But it also includes it a lot, so yeah, not innocent either.
Travis says in his question that he doesn't want this stuff in his leisure activities, and I feel like it's worth drawing the distinction between, I'm totally okay with games dealing with this as a piece of subject matter, I'm not okay with when they have these things as you say, Tom, a shortcut in a scene, or when it is something which is just glaringly a dumb action game, and then they suddenly deal with this really serious political issue, a really grimy topic, and do it no justice whatsoever, because it's not what the game's about.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily want rape and torture and so forth in my dumb entertainment.
Yeah.
Jason writes, Dear Crate and Crowbar, I recently discovered your podcast and have been slowly working my way through the backlog. In one episode, when asked what he had been playing lately, Graham answered, An Hour of Football Manager, before the pod moved on to someone else. This led me to wonder, has creating a weekly gaming podcast changed the way you choose which games to play? Do you feel a greater need to try new games now than you're regularly expected to talk about them in a group chat? While I'm sure many of the games you discuss come about through your day jobs, does the need for a good discussion on the pod every week draw you to certain types of games? Thanks for the podcast, which has gotten me through many long commutes. Jason. Well, Tom.
Well, I just talked about Mark twice today for some reason because I hadn't played anything.
Did you read about that so you could talk about it on the pod today?
No, I wasn't, but it occurred to me that it did make me think about games and sandbox games, so I thought I'd bring it up. But ordinarily, yeah. I mean, I would have talked about Mushroom 11, but I often find that, like, you guys, we often kind of land on some of the same things, and then I've got nothing really to add about Mushroom 11.
So, I also, like, where I can, I also prefer not to crap on something. Like, I sort of informally, like, I wouldn't necessarily hold other people to this, but I almost informally see that my role, if I have one, with this thing, is being like, hey, I heard about this cool game on the Crane Crowbar, and I want to go play it. As opposed to, hey, how to get this game on the Crane Crowbar? Never going anywhere near it. Like, we do that plenty, but it's, you know, I'd like to go out and find something that no one had heard of that was super cool that I could explain. But most of the time, what happens is, oh, this is the most interesting thing I've played this week, or, you know, whatever. And I also play Destiny.
It definitely factors into my thinking when it comes to playing stuff during the week, both in terms of, like, I kind of want to go play Mushroom 11, but I haven't had time to play many games over the last 5 or 6 days, and I didn't want to play Mushroom 11 because it was talked about on last week's pod.
Mm.
And there are certain kinds of games which are just better or easier to talk about on the podcast than others, like narrative games or things that are easily spoiled or that kind of stuff is, you know, a little bit harder to talk about, or maybe just doesn't lead to the kind of emergent story making that makes for good anecdotes that you want to share. In terms of like positive versus negative, I'd always rather be positive, and there's lots of stuff that I play which is just, oh, that's a bit crap, or that's just not very interesting, so I won't mention it. But if it's a game which I feel like listeners will have heard of because it's been promoted elsewhere, or it's a really big budget thing, so it's being advertised everywhere, it feels like it's still performing a service to say, actually, this thing's shit, or actually, this thing's broken. Even though it's not, you know, what I'd prefer to do. Prefer to, like you say, find something good.
Mm.
And I think that this leads to a problem as well, where we also, I think, sometimes try to play different things from one another. Mm. So we've each got our own unique thing to talk about on the pod, which leads to the situation that we're in a little bit this week, where over the last 2 weeks, four of us have been on the pod and each one's played a different game and talked about that different game. And so of the games that have been released over the last couple of weeks, we've already talked about 8 of them. And so if someone else has played Mushroom 11, it's like, well, we already covered that. Yeah. We already covered Keep Talking, although I brought it up again.
you just gotta bring the mice. That's what you gotta do. That's
you gotta break the glass marked whatever the fuck I read today.
Let that one run.
Like, there's no rule, basically. I think I would always prefer to talk about something new, but you end up with these weird problems as well, where, like, someone will come on, it's usually Tom Francis that will introduce some brilliant system-driven game that I never heard of, that I will want to go then and play, but me then playing it is of less value to the podcast, because I'm not going to have a better insight on it than Tom is. So, should I play it, even though I want to play it for fun, but I have finite time? Should I go and play something else? And that's a weird situation to end up in. So I guess it has changed the way I play games. It certainly changed the amount of shame I feel about playing Dota.
And me about Football Manager.
Yeah.
Especially what with no one caring about football on this podcast than me. Yeah, I should get access to Football Manager 2016 in the next few days, and so I will be talking about that probably on next week's
looking
pod.
Looking forward to it.
Sure you are. Yeah, I'm sure the listeners are as well.
I'm looking forward to it. I've been playing loads of Heroes of the Storm recently. I haven't said anything about it on the podcast because I can actually imagine certain readers listeners turning inside out, like the moment it gets onto Wizard Chat again.
I talked about Downwell on the pod last week because I was really enjoying it. I'm still really enjoying it, so I'm still playing it. That's why I haven't played much else.
Yeah. I think there are definitely things like, you know, the forays into console land. Like, I play a lot on PS4 now, and it's because it's not work, and there's something really nice about going to a different room in the house to play games that couldn't conceivably be work, which I know is a problem exclusive to people who got very lucky with what their work is. But I played Uncharted for the first time recently. Like, a super famous game series. I've never touched it before, and I played the first one in one day. Like, played the whole thing in, like, an afternoon. I've got a million different ideas about it that are probably deeply tiresome at this point, but I will spare the podcast them because, A, it's not a PC game and almost certainly never will be, but also it's kind of nice to have just played something that was about a man who jumps and shoots people that I don't necessarily need to really fucking lay into hot take wise.
Yeah, I like that too.
It's quite good. There you go.
Weird games journalism problems.
Yep. That's a cool noise, Graham.
Nick writes, "Hey, Cro-maniacs, I have the itch.
Oh no.
The expensive Razer mechanical keyboard and Logitech adjustable white mouse and Cytec flag yoke with throttle and giant Dota 2 mousepad I got at TI5, humble brag, and Xbox One gamepad that clutter my desk are not enough. The decision to buy another horrible PC gaming peripheral has already been made in the future. The horror of that event is rippling into the past, and now all that is left is to be resigned to my fate. How have you ever suffered from this? Have you had a peripheral you actually enjoyed or remember because of its uselessness? Some of those late 90s FPS joysticks designed to let you circle strafe that were reviewed on PCG were horrible. And do any disgusting peripherals sit on your desk today? Resigned future Razer Orb Weaver owner, Nick from Minnesota, USA. What is the Razer Orb Weaver? Is that a real thing?
Fuck no, that's not a real snake. That's just the Orb Weaver.
I think the most pointless thing I've encountered was the Novint Falcon.
Oh, that was stupid.
A really weird thing, which is like it's a giant ball with four arms coming off it to a connected small circle. I don't know how you're imagining that right now, because I'll explain that really badly. But it's designed to let you kind of push and pull and move a controller around while it's attached to this thing, and it resists you in a certain way.
It's 3D space, basically.
Yeah, and it also, if you attach a gun thing to it, it'll give you kind of kickback and stuff. And it's really dumb. You know, Google it. It's a silly thing that I wanted to mess around with.
Pretty cool to set that up with, like, Penumbra, the only game that would work for it.
Yeah,
that open those fucking doors. Yeah, it'd be great to use it now with like Alien Isolation or Amnesia.
I don't know if you were around at this time, Graham. I think you were. Didn't we have that weird moment in the office when someone found, because we were super busy, and I think it was Rich McCormick, found a video of like a very bored looking businessman, fully clothed, demonstrating like a new virtual sex toy at like some sort of like, I think it was maybe like Japanese sex toy expo or something. and it was like this armature that would sort of sit in 3D space, and it had a sex toy attached to it, and this man, bored looking man, was sort of dry humping away at it in order to demonstrate the dystopian future that awaits everybody. And
Rich moved to Japan.
Moved to Japan almost immediately after this. I'm putting it on Rich. It might not have been Rich. I think it was Rich. And then we had this moment realization where it's like, hang on, this isn't a bespoke device. That's a sex toy attached to an Ovid Falcon. And there's an Ovid Falcon in the drawer over there. And like everyone's head turned at once to where this thing was, like suddenly realizing that it's found its only actual use as far as anyone could tell, which was to be dry humped in an expo. That's a shit peripheral.
We had a few different things like that, but they were almost all that kind of thing, like physics-y kind of feeling-y kickback feedback things that we would use once or twice. I borrowed it from you guys,
the finger thing.
Yeah, finger thing. Cast light. What's it called?
I have no idea what it's called, the finger thing.
Oh, I can't remember what it's called. It's designed to enable Minority Report style swipe gestures
thing.
The air.
What is that?
Your fingers, yeah.
The fingerly thing that doesn't work.
You hold your hands above it and it shoots lasers at them, and it can, I mean, there's lots of stuff that does motion control in the air, but this is interesting because it can actually track each of your individual fingers in 3D space, so you can hold your fingers. Yeah, swear at it. Hold your fingers like guns and pull the trigger and have it actually fire a gun and that sort of stuff. And it works, I would say, about 98% of the time, but when what you're making is a control method, any failure is enormously frustrating.
Yeah.
And failing 2% of the time is fucking huge when it's the difference between living and dying in a game or clicking on the right thing on your Windows interface and not.
Yeah. There's loads of this sort of stuff, fans that will blow in your face that you can attach to the keyboard to keep your hands cool.
What was the whole thing about coloured lights, Ambiex? Yeah.
What was the thing that we got it in the office a while ago? This was after your time, I think, Graham. What was the thing that electrocuted you to make you better at games?
Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
It was like a headband or something.
Mm. God.
That had like a battery in it, and the idea is it would like stimulate your brain and make you better at games somehow, and it made me feel profoundly sick.
Oh, shit.
Like, like in that sort of like, no, this is, no, I don't want to be electrocuted there.
Yeah.
Stop it, kind of way. It was, and like, I think they left like a copy in it for feedback or something. Like, hey, what do you guys think? You know, is your KD in Battlefield shot up through the roof and she started electrocuting your brain? And then, like, the feedback was unanimously, like, I never want to see this thing again. Like, it's Pavlovian, like, punish response to it, where it's like, I don't, please don't make me wear the electric collar. Yeah. Like, I'll be good.
We had one for a while that was a similar headband, which was designed to track, like, micro expressions. Well, it was supposed to be, yeah, that you could just think, look left in a game, then you would look left, or think, move forward, and you would move forward. It couldn't actually read your brainwaves, though, although that was... that what the PR said that it could do and would not waver from that. Actually, it was just picking up on movements in your muscles and your forehead. And it didn't work.
I don't know about you, but whenever I think move forward, I scowl like really hardcore. Yeah. Like, that way you can visibly see.
That reminds me of my favourite thing about shit, really deeply shit PlayStation adventure game Until Dawn, which came out recently and people inexplicably raved about. It's dumb. Is that there are moments where your character has to make a decision, and this is briefly relevant, and it, which could be about going left or right or supporting someone and being mean to them or whatever. And during these crucial decision moments, it cuts into a close-up shot of their face, and it'll put the decisions either side of their face, and you move the stick to choose which decision you want. But the character looks at the decision they're about to make as if it's a real thing. Like, as if yeah, they've actually shown up. And so that those are the only people in the existence who that headset would work on, because they actually look to the conceptual, like the icon representing the choice they're about to make as if it's a real thing. And you can do this to make a very weird and uncanny valley-ish representation of actress Hayden Panettiere look like she's about to pass out by just waggling the stick back and forth until she looks like she's had a seizure. That's the best thing in that shit game.
That game has been passed around the office for couples to play and laugh at, basically, at the moment.
Me and Marsh played it.
Yeah, well, it system works. I'm currently playing with my girlfriend at the moment, because you can just like drink some wine and play it, and it's hilarious. Yeah. Dreadful. It's really bad.
Are you in the same position? I know this is irrelevant to the subject of this podcast. Are you in the same position I am with it, where it's like, why was this getting op-eds about how great it was?
Yeah. I don't know what came over people. Maybe the people enjoyed it as kind of pulpy nonsense, like Deadly Premonition kind of people love that.
It's great if you're drunk.
Like, yeah, it is good if you're drunk. It's very funny. It's fucking bad.
I haven't played this game, but I did have a keyboard made of lasers for a little while.
Yeah.
What it did is it projected your keyboard onto the actual surface of your desk, like a light keyboard, and then it could track where you were interrupting those lights, basically, in order to register key presses. So you could type by just banging your fingers painfully against the wooden surface of your desk. Like, that was ever going to be a good idea.
Oh, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I do definitely get the pull towards, like, upgrading stuff. Like, I'm starting to feel a PC upgrade pull at the moment. Because I think the other part of the question was, like, do you ever get that thing where you kind of have this whim to spend stupid amounts of money on something you don't need? And then there's the moment you know you're going to, but you haven't yet. But you're, like, on the slippery slope towards, like, I own this now. Okay. And...
Sorry.
So go on. Go.
I was going to say, I can't remember if it was last week or 2 weeks ago, but I talked about the fact that I now own a Steam controller and a Steam Link. Neither of things were things that I needed, and both of which were, you know, pre-ordering first-generation hardware. You know that they're not going to be great. You know they're not going to work perfectly. You know that even if they do work perfectly, it's going to be after a whole bunch of setup.
Yeah.
Still did that. Still spent money on those things.
Yep. I mean, I was saying this in our break, but I was in London this weekend. I went to a shop to buy some pen and paper role-playing stuff. I realised that the Star Wars X-Wing miniatures game, which is a strategy miniatures game thing that's been running for a couple of years now, has filled in the gaps in its roster of miniatures for the different factions by using ships that were originally designed for Star Wars Galaxies. And I walked out of that shop without buying any. Thought about it for 2 days, knowing that the decision had already been made. Went back today on the way back from London. I was like, I'd like to buy all of these, please. I'm a man with nothing better to do and probably too much disposable income, and we'll solve all the problems with regards to who I'm going to play this with later. For now, I'd like to own these little plastic spaceships, please. Thank you.
The person in the store said, "We know.
Yeah.
We saw you here 2 days ago." And
eyeing over that Imperial Decimator.
They knew. They're like, "We knew. We saw you."
They fucking got me. Like, I could have resisted until the moment they fucking put Star Wars Galaxy spaceships in there. That's too personal.
I've got a Logitech steering wheel. I've got a HOTAS Warthog.
That's a hot-ass Warthog. I think that every single time.
I've probably called it that in the office, and it's very expensive.
That was really funny.
It's like 300 quid or something.
I stood up and it fell off, and the stick broke off the...
It's made of, like, fucking solid metal as
found
well.
Found a way, man. Found a way to break the fuck out of that thing.
Two parts as well. It's really heavy because it's the joystick and then the throttle as well. Despite owning that, I then bought the Cytec X52 because it's the one that matches the stick and Elite. Yep.
Yep. Do you see that? I watched a bit of the live stream for Elite Dangerous's new planetary stuff. We drive around in buggies on procedurally generated rocky planets. And they said, like, you know, these buggies have a vertical dimension to them, the way they can jump, basically, like the Mako and Mass Effect. Mm. Don't go out and buy steering wheels. Like, the first question a lot of people had is, like, do I need a steering wheel? Like, not in a kind of, like, oh my god, are you going to make me buy a whole bunch of new peripherals to go with the thing that I've already bought shitloads of peripherals for, but in a kind of like, okay, what else do I need? Like, I built an actual pit in the living room with a cockpit in it.
Yeah.
Do I also need, next to it, a buggy? No, apparently you don't. Sounds good.
Were people disappointed? Were people like,
I can't imagine.
I thought this was going to be my excuse.
It was one of those one-sided things where it's like, question from the readers, and then they answer it. But I kind of imagine that guy, like, just, like, sort of a finger hovering above the buy button on Amazon for some really incredibly expensive steering wheel rig or something, going like, oh, all right then, fine.
That's all the time for questions that we have.
If you would like to send us a question for a future episode, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum, which is also where you'll find the episode discussion thread for this episode. You can send us a question on Twitter. We are at Creighton Crowbar. You can also discuss this episode and ask questions to other listeners, and then they might answer them, and that's a conversation then, on our Discord channel, which is a chat thing that's cool now that everyone uses. And our reader set us up a really cool chat channel that has multiple parts to it. It's good. And you can find a link to that on the front of the website, on the sidebar, like bottom of the sidebar on the main page of the website, creatingcrowbar.com. There's a link which will give you you'll need a Discord account already, but when you click that link, it'll automatically invite you to the right channel. So that's cool. If you would like to follow us as individuals, I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
I am at Gonnas, GONNAS.
I'm at PCG Ludo, which is LUDO.
And finally, if you'd like to become a very valued supporter on Patreon, you can do that by visiting us at creightoncrowbar.com. No, hang on. patreon.com/creightoncrowbar. We've used those donations to buy brilliant sound equipment that by this time next week, we will have learned how to remove from the room they're currently set up in. Hopefully this one didn't sound too bad, and I apologize if it did.
Thanks.
Blah, 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 blah.